This is an audio archive edition of WINA's Charlottesville Right Now with Coy Barefoot, made available online by the Charlottesville Podcasting Network, cvillepodcast.com.
Ronald Denberg joins me in studio here on Rose Hill Drive. He's a member of the Corcoran Department of History at the University of Virginia and an expert on Korea and China. And he is speaking tomorrow at the Miller Center of Public Affairs at 11 o'clock as part of the forum program. This event is free. It's open to the public. You just want to get there early and get a good seat. And again, that's 11 o'clock tomorrow at the Miller Center on Old Ivy Road. But we'll get a little preview of his talk today right here on Charlottesville Right Now. Ron, it's good to see you. Thank you for coming in.
Thank you. Good to be here.
So what is it? Let me just ask you right off the top. Well, let's look at China first, because China's certainly in the news more often, I guess, than Korea. In all your research and your travels to China and your understanding, what is it you think most Americans don't know, or that we don't really get about China, that from where you sit, as you teach the history of China and the culture and the politics, that you absolutely think we probably should know here at the dawn of the 21st century?
I'm not sure that how many Americans realize how fundamental the changes that have occurred over the past 20, 25 years in China, how fundamental those changes are. I still hear students express surprise when people question whether China is still a communist country. It's not communist. It's not Red China. They don't realize how many extremely wealthy people there are in China. And you do not become extremely wealthy. You do not become millionaires and billionaires under a strict, purist communist system. This is a system that is now generating enormous wealth. There is also a huge gap between the wealthy and, for example, the very poor people out in the countryside. There is an enormous gap, and that, I think, is something of concern for the Chinese leaders.
So the China of our youth, the Red China, that is gone.
That is gone.
Yeah.
That is gone. That is gone. And it's something that has been building for the past several decades, actually since the late 70s and early 80s. It continues to gather momentum. But that does not mean, in spite of the enormous wealth that is being generated in China and in spite of the enormous wealth that some of the Chinese citizens possess, that there are no significant problems. The environment is a very significant problem. Water is a significant problem and will continue to be for a long time to come. There are serious problems, domestic problems in China, even as China continues to expand its influence globally. Certainly its influence within the region of Northeast Asia and its influence globally as well.
We are honored to be talking with historian Ron Denberg of the University of Virginia, and he's speaking tomorrow at the Miller Center on Old Ivy Road at 11 o'clock. It's a free event open to the public, and the phone lines are open now at 977-1070. Does the government of China still cling in some way to communism, even if only for symbolic, historical power?
The Communist Party is still in power, and the rhetoric certainly leads you to believe that they do cling to communism, if for no other reason, as a symbol. But the rhetoric is certainly heavily laden with communist terminology and communist concepts, yes.
But the economic system that is the driving force now in China
is changing very rapidly and has been changing
for some time. Is very capitalist.
Yes.
And maybe not capitalist, because there seems to be a real collusion on the part of government and and business,
yes,
which we see in this country, of course, but even more so in China.
More so there. Indeed.
And talk about that a little bit. Are these then, could you argue, state industries, or is there just
state,
a lot
there
of...
There are state industries as well as privately owned enterprises. And, of course, Western countries and the Japanese and the Koreans are very much involved in the economy as well.
Yeah. What are they doing so right? I mean, why is it that banks, for example, in our country, after we've given them, you know, billions to bail them out, they aren't giving loans to businesses in America. They're investing in China and getting, you know, 8-10% return.
Well, I think the major issue here is the level of wages in China. It costs a lot less in China to produce a particular item than it does in this country. And this is why there is so much movement of business and industry, manufacturing and so on to China and other countries as well. But certainly this is why China is attracting so much attention from business and enterprise, because the cost of labor is so modest.
And we're talking with Ron Denberg of the University of Virginia. Let's talk about that for a minute, because I find that fascinating that American industry, you know, arguably for the first phase of American history, it relied in large part on cheap immigrant labor, slave labor. And then manufacturing in America was always searching for the cheapest labor it could find. I mean, the manufacturing across Southern Virginia, that was there, those textiles and furniture, and that was there because that was cheap labor when they set up shop in the 20th century. Now those jobs have gone elsewhere in search of cheap labor, and it's taken them overseas to places like China.
Many indeed, yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
What has been the effect? We've seen the effect in America of all these jobs going elsewhere. It's made America now a country where we really don't make anything anymore. And as far as I'm concerned, that's dangerous. That's a dangerous place to be when you're a country not making anything. It makes you weak. And yet we've taken this power and given it to the Chinese people now.
One of the major effects is the migration from the rural countryside into the cities and look in search of jobs on the shop floor, manufacturing items, many of which then end up in our shops and our stores and in our homes.
Yeah.
It's the migration from the rural areas into the urban areas in search of jobs and manufacturing.
And in terms of the sort of the arc of Chinese history, It does this represent a truly significant? I mean, could this be said to be one of the great migrations in Chinese history?
I would not go so far as to say it represents one of the great migrations in Chinese history, because there have been some monumental migrations over the centuries. But this is certainly significant. This is certainly significant, and it is causing some social issues, and it is causing concern on the part of the government.
Are we seeing anything like a union movement or workers' rights movements in China?
You do on occasion hear reports of disturbances on the part of workers, on the part of people working on the shop floor and so on, that I suppose might coalesce in time into a full-scale labor movement.
But not quite.
Not quite yet.
We're not quite there yet. We're talking with Ron Denberg of the University of Virginia. So where do you – what's your – when you look into your crystal ball, I mean, where do you – you've seen significant change now in China over the last few decades. Where is this going? Can this growth sustain itself, and this, you know, very rapid social change that's happening in this country?
That is a question that China specialists are constantly discussing. The speculation is endless where this is going. And the literature – that is available, and there is a lot of literature on this now, a lot of it coming over the computer frequently in the form of online publications, drawing on the international community of scholars. There is simply a lot of disagreement, a lot of speculation, a lot of disagreement, a lot of head-scratching about this. There are people who are not particularly optimistic. There are people who argue that the environmental issues, I mentioned water a few moments ago, natural resources and so on, will be a break on continued development. This is something that will play itself out, but I would not hazard a guess about where China will be 10 to 15 years from now.
Yeah. What's your reaction to some of the more conservative, nativist backlash against the Chinese, as some in this country, politicians or some in the extreme media, try to make China into the next Russia, and you know that just because they're doing well, that they're our new enemy.
I've always been impatient with people who see China as the next enemy. China does not have a history of being bellicose, unless they sense or see hostility on their borders, as was the case back in 1950 during the Korean War. The Chinese entered that war when the UN forces approached the northern frontier of Korea, that is to say, the border with China. China, frankly, does not have a history of being aggressive towards the outside world unless it feels threatened.
Yeah.
China right now is having considerable success globally in spreading its influence. I don't see all things being equal, and seldom are all things equal, of course, but I do not see China running the risk right now of undermining everything that it has achieved. Now, we have, as we speak, we have China and Japan are locked in a confrontation. This in Northeast Asia is full of territorial disputes, and the Chinese are involved in several of them. One never knows when something like that is going to flare up, as this issue with the Japanese did just a few days ago. But I do not anticipate China becoming a particularly aggressive, a particularly hostile power in Northeast Asia if the rest of us behave ourselves.
What about Tibet? What's the latest on Tibet?
The latest on Tibet is that China, the People's Republic of China, still exercises control over Tibet, obviously, and the Dalai Lama is still in northern India, and there are people who argue that Tibet ought to be free. That is a significant bone of contention, obviously.
Yeah.
Yes,
we do see China. Am I right? I've read elsewhere that China is, funding some of the wars in Africa in a quest to secure some of the resources.
China is certainly in search of resources in Africa. Whether the Chinese are funding the uprisings and the wars, I cannot comment on that.
Yeah. We're talking with Ronald Denberg of the University of Virginia, a professor in the Corcoran Department of History. He's speaking tomorrow at the Miller Center of Public Affairs at 11 o'clock on Old Ivy Road. With the time that we have left, I'm interested in your thoughts about Korea. And again, I would ask you the same question about Korea, North or South or both. What is it you think Americans don't get or don't understand that we absolutely should?
This is the topic of my conversation tomorrow at the Miller Center of Korea. One fact that we often overlook is that the Korean War is not over. An armistice was signed in July of 1953, not a peace treaty. So there is no permanent peace on the Korean Peninsula. This is something that we tend to forget, I think, and this is a significant fact. The animosity between the North and the South that existed before the war started in June of 1950 continued to intensify after the armistice in the 50s and 60s and beyond, of course. That animosity waxes and wanes. There was the great sunshine policy at the end of the 1990s and into the early 20th century, authored by Kim Dae-jung. That did have an effect of reducing tension on the peninsula.
And we saw families reunited.
There were families reunited, or at least families were able to visit each other for the first time in decades.
Yeah.
And there were other positive effects of that sunshine policy. That has since been reduced in significance by the current president, Lee Myung-bak, there is still hostility and animosity. We saw this again with the sinking of the Chunan naval vessel back in March. Whether or not Pyongyang was responsible for that, that did heat things up considerably on the peninsula and in Northeast Asia.
Yeah,
I think it is very important to remember that. The division of the peninsula now along the DMZ, the animosity and hostility between North Korea and South Korea and between North Korea and the United States is very much a regional issue, which I think is why it is so important that the six-party talks be revived. I think that the six-party talks are very significant development. They've been silent since 2008, and the hope is that they will be revived, renewed in the fairly near future.
How dangerous is North Korea or North Korea's nuclear weapons or its leadership, which, the picture is painted here in the popular media that we're dealing with a crazy man who's got nuclear weapons. How dangerous is this really?
That's a dangerous perception and a very narrow, distorted perception. When we hear that Kim Jong-il is a crazy man and so on, no, this is definitely not true. And people who have dealt with him, for example, Secretary of State Madeleine Albright back in the 90s during the Clinton administration came back saying that she had a very productive, rational, challenging, stimulating conversation with Kim. The record shows, at least as far as I'm concerned, and this is a point I want to make tomorrow, the record shows that very often over the past 60 years, Pyongyang, the behavior of Pyongyang, rather than being provocative, as it is often characterized in the American press, has been defensive. Very often they are reacting to, responding to threats, or at least perceived threats from the outside, as often or not from the United States, because we have had large numbers of very heavily armed troops in the South since the end of the war. Between 1958 and 1991, we had nuclear weapons in the South. So the DPRK, the North Korea, was under, at least in their own minds, threatened by a nuclear power from the South, the United States. And this has often, I think, precipitated some of the behavior from the North that in the American press is often portrayed as being bellicose or provocative rather than simply defensive.
Yeah. If we had a flare-up in Korea again, would we see China getting involved?
Ah, that is the $64,000, $64 million question, isn't
yeah.
it? The last thing China wants to see right now is that kind of dislocation in Northeast Asia, that kind, any kind of...
It's not good for business.
It is not good for business. It is not good for their emerging image as a global power. They do not want to see a collapsed North Korea. They do not want to see a renewed hostilities on the Korean Peninsula. I think that rather than speculate about whether or not they would get involved, I think it is more important to assume that they would do everything they could do to stop this before the hostilities are renewed.
Ronald Denberg is a professor in the Corcoran Department of History at the University of Virginia. He'll be speaking tomorrow about Korea at the Miller Center of Public Affairs at 11 a.m. on Old Ivy Road. Get there early, get a good seat, and you can continue the conversation with Ron at that time. Thank you very much for being
My
here.
My pleasure. Thank you for the invitation.
You've been listening to Charlottesville Right Now with Coy Barefoot. Charlottesville Right Now is broadcast live Monday through Friday on News Radio 1070 WINA from 4 to 6 p.m. Best-selling author and historian Coy Barefoot is the host and producer. To interact with Coy and his guests, you can call 434-977-1070. Coy can be reached at barefoot@wina.com. This audio download has been made possible by the Charlottesville Podcasting Network. Visit seavillepodcast.com for more.